And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Metrospective presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. I'm Ted Berg and I am joined in Zoom conference by the Athletics Mets beat writer, Tim Britton. Tim, the Mets injuries keep piling up, and yet they take 2 out of 3 in Atlanta.
Yeah, and came really close to sweeping that series, which would have been their first sweep of the Braves in Atlanta since, I think, early 2016, which is a long time ago, Ted.
Impossibly long. 2016 is impossibly, that is a long 5 years.
You got some really good performances from, it's not even the bench mob anymore because the guys are in the starting lineup on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. Like the offense is being carried by Jonathan VR, Tomas Nito. Jose Peraza, in fact, is not on the bench mob t-shirt that we talked about last time. He wasn't there yet. And now he is also part of the starting lineup. They need to have like bench mob 2, the sequel t-shirt come out with Jake Hager and Patrick Mazika and Wilfredo Tovar. Our friend from 2014 back on it or something like that, because the depth of roster contributions has been really impressive. Tuesday, I think, really stands out for that because you used most of the roster from a position player standpoint and got, big hits from guys like Jhenashree Fargis and Nito, a big defensive play from Khalil Lee. And then you had the bullpen, 7 different guys covering the 9 innings to get you through that game and pitching really well. Through those 9 innings. So that was, I think, they've had a couple candidates for their best win of the season over the last 2 weeks, and that one's right up there.
Yeah, and I guess it's a good thing that the minor league season has started, because you feel like this would really tax the games at the alternate site if that were still a thing.
I don't know that they'd be having games at the alternate site. Like, I saw that Syracuse lost 16-1 on Wednesday night, and my thought was that, like, did they just start throwing position players in like the 4th inning because they didn't have anyone else to pitch? It wasn't that way. And I think the Mets actually have used that strategy when they were in Vegas on occasion with their AAA team. But yeah, like the minor league team is taxed a bit as, they skipped Thomas Zupacki because he might be starting this weekend. They held Jordan Yamamoto to 2 innings on Wednesday night because he might be starting this weekend. They've got some holes to fill in the rotation going forward. You can't have games like Tuesday too often. So we'll see how they handle that moving forward now with basically two healthy starters.
And, you mentioned all the injuries, and we discussed this earlier, but I guess the silver lining to having most of your team on the injured list is that at some point, most of your team will return from the injured list. Give me some good news here, Tim.
Some good news is that
there's a pregnant pause. That's not good.
It's been 75 to 80 degrees in New York. It's been really nice,
yeah.
Ted.
It was like a full blown 85 on Wednesday, right? It was hot. It was sleeveless weather.
Yeah, I when I went out to run an errand early in the day, I was like, nope, too hot. We got there too quickly. Go back. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be wearing my long sleeve button down shirt in this next week covering the homestand. The good news
You got to make the switch to golf shirts. Do you have to wait for Memorial Day, or can you make that switch?
No, I don't like polo shirts. No, they don't fit me well. So it's button down, and the sleeves are always up on the button down. Like I haven't worn a button down with the sleeves down outside of a suit context since I was like 5 years old. But it's still the polo shirt doesn't work for me. I don't know why.
It doesn't look good on me either, but I, for comfort's sake, it is a necessary. And I go with like the most minimally formal polo shirts available, which is basically like a t-shirt with a collar on it. Because if I'm in any setting like that, spring training is really the main one where it's like, I can't wear a button down shirt. I got to sweat. I'm a sweaty man.
Oh yeah. I mean, spring training is different. I have like 15 polo shirts and it's just, I'll wear them all in a row. The 15 days I'm at spring training, then I'll fly back and I'll wash them and then I'll bring them back down. And that's the only time of year I really wear them.
That's the story of my cargo shorts too.
The good news, so you've got Jacob deGrom is making a rehab start. I mean, the good news is that your St. Lucie rotation is pretty lights out at the moment. You got Seth Lugo in it. You got Noah Syndergaard. You've got Jacob deGrom. deGrom starting on Thursday. That lines him up. If everything goes well there, he could be back in the big league rotation by Tuesday, which means he just misses kind of one more start than you expected. Syndergaard looked really good, as far as you could tell, on game day. On MILB.com on Wednesday, in his four innings, he gave up just one hit, struck out, I think, five, and was really efficient and in the strike zone. Lugo only threw four pitches for his three outs on Tuesday, which is actually like annoyingly efficient if you're the Mets. You probably wanted him to have a little bit more action in there. These absences, none of these, you look at the entire roster, they've got 14 guys on the injured list. And really, none of them are long-term serious ones. This isn't, you know, you compare it to like 2009 when they went through so many injuries.
It was out for the season, yeah.
Yeah, and you had Carlos Delgado, he was out for the year. You had Jose Reyes with a hamstring or calf injury that didn't seem like it was initially going to be a season-ending one, but was, you know, was a month plus, and then it just kind of slowly morphed into a season-ending one. John Main had some pretty significant shoulder injuries pretty early in that season. I think the most serious one they're dealing with, you know, besides Jose Martinez, who's still out until at least the All-Star break, and a guy who probably would be taking on a larger role had he been healthy in the current mm-hmm. moment, you know, it's probably you're looking at the Conforto and McNeil hamstring strains as probably the longest term thing here. And those are probably not things that are keeping you out for months, that they're kind of week to week, as Luis Rojas has said. They're not these really long-term things. So you can envision, you know, having most of your roster back and even more of your roster back than you had at the start of the season, you know, within the next month or so.
Well, and the Carlos Carrasco injury situation seems increasingly murky.
That's true. Like that he still hasn't gone out on a rehab assignment, that, you know, we were expecting that to happen. Really, I think the first week of May was when they put him on the 60-day injured list. Let me look that up. I've got that right. Yeah, May 6th, they moved him to the 60. And that was, you know, it seemed like he was just about to make, you know, a rehab start or two and then be back in the rotation by this point in time, by May 20th when we're recording this. He still hasn't done that. You know, it's probably time to ask Luis Rojas. You know, the update yesterday that we got from the update on Wednesday that we got from him is just that, you know, he's progressing. He's playing catch out to more than 100 feet. He's getting there, but is not quite there to pitch in game action. And you know, we've talked about it the whole season. When he starts doing that, it's not going to be one start and in. I don't think. I think it's going to be a few starts because he hasn't seen competition at any point in 2021. So I think he might be, in terms of pitchers, it looked like he was ahead of Lugo and Syndergaard for most of that stretch. And now I think you'd have to say he's behind both of those guys. He certainly went behind Lugo when he went to the 60-day, and now is behind Syndergaard, I think, as well.
We got something special today on the Metrospective. New York Post beat writer Mike Puma, longtime beat writer, has a new book out called If These Walls Could Talk, and Tim was able to sit down with Mike for an interview to discuss the book and his time, his tenure on the Mets beat. It's a great interview, and it's coming up right now.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
I'm joined by Mike Puma of the New York Post. He's been the Post beat writer covering the New York Mets since 2010, and he's been covering the team in some capacity Since 1998, he's also the author of If These Walls Could Talk, Stories from the New York Mets Dugout, Locker Room, and Press Box, which came out earlier this month. Mike, thanks for taking some time on your travel day to chat with us.
Thanks for having me today, Tim.
The book covers a little more than the last two decades in Mets history. It basically goes back to that 98 season when you were with, the Connecticut Post at that point, and the Mets made that trade for Mike Piazza. What was it like to start covering the team at that point in time, really when they kind of made that switch from being kind of a middle-of-the-road team to a team that mattered in the National League?
Yeah, that was right about the time I started with baseball. I had started that season 98 at the Connecticut Post, and you know, Bobby Valentine was a local guy born and raised in Stamford, and the team had played pretty well in 97, so they had me start covering the Mets in 98, and Piazza gets there in May, and you're right, it really transforms the franchise, because you know they have a good scrappy team and everything like that. You think of some of the players on that roster, whether it was Olerud was a good player, Edgardo Alfonso was a good player, Ray Ordonia, but they really lacked that legitimate middle of the order presence, and Piazza brought that presence and also that star appeal, you know, because you looked across town at the time, and the Yankees, you know, they had won the World Series in 96 and they were on their way to begin another run there with, you know, they had Derek Jeter, Tino Martinez, Bernie Williams, Mariano, right down the line. The Mets didn't have that. All of a sudden, Mike Piazza gets here and changes things a little bit.
Yeah, it seemed like you had a pretty good conversation with Mike for the book, especially going into, the 2000 Subway Series and game two of that series with Roger Clemens. What was that conversation like with him?
I was surprised how forthcoming Piazza was. You know, you would think after all these years and probably as many times as he's been asked about it, he'd want to dance around it maybe and say, but, you know, he got into the details of it and the one thing I found interesting, he recounted being in the trainer's room and getting a phone call, Dr. Hershon from the Yankees is in there with him, and Clemens calling on the phone and tell him to go F himself. I don't want to talk to him. And I thought that was a nice little detail he added. Mike was very forthcoming it's something he hasn't forgotten about, something that's, he still thinks about.
What was it like to cover Valentine with those teams? It was such an interesting dynamic that he had with the media. I saw it a little bit the one year I covered him in Boston, but it had to be to a different level in New York over a few years.
Yeah, and he was the right guy at the right time, I think, for the Mets. You know, he was unbelievably colorful. And, you know, you had the tension between him and Steve Phillips, who was the GM at the time. So you really had this schism developing within the organization. And I mentioned this, I think, in the introduction of the book. You know, at one point it got to the new writers assigned to cover the team, Valentine would quiz him. Are you a Valentine guy? Or are you a Steve Phillips guy? You know, it kind of put the writers in an awkward position right off the bat. But he was, from a tactical standpoint, I think he was as good as any manager in the game. But he also had the penchant for controversy, rubbing guys the wrong way. You had factions within the clubhouse, guys who, and you mentioned Boston. Well, you saw that in Boston, obviously, what happened in the clubhouse with the players revolting against him. But he was wildly entertaining, very smart. I just find him to be a fascinating guy. He's been so successful in many aspects of his life. You know, he's had he's run restaurants. He's running for mayor of Stamford, Connecticut. He's been the athletic director at Sacred Heart University. Very accomplished public speaker. He's just very successful on many levels.
Yeah, I was pretty excited when the Red Sox hired him, just to get a chance to see what it was like to cover him. And I think that was the right guy at the wrong time for that yes. team. It was a totally different team.
Well, it's funny because, you know, Valentine had, after he got fired by the Mets, he went off to Japan and had success over there, won a championship. And it seems like at the point he came back to manage in the major leagues, that decade so much had changed where it was now more a player's game. You know, it wasn't the old school of it's you know, the manager's in charge and this is the way we're going to do things. I think so much had changed, and along with the analytics revolution too, where, you know, Valentine wasn't, you know, used to somebody coming in his office with a book of statistics and saying, hey, let's do this and this. And, you know, Valentine's like, what's going on here? You know, a lot had changed in that decade he was away.
Yeah, and like he had been the guy, you know, in AAA for the Mets prior to taking the big job, and was kind of there as guys got older. You know, he inherited a team that was a little younger as they were learning to win, whereas in Boston he was taking over a team that those guys had been there for a little bit.
That was a veteran team.
A lot of veterans, yeah.
Yeah.
How awkward is that dynamic with him and Phillips, like like you said, you have to choose sides essentially between which guy you like.
You got to walk the fine line, obviously. And, you know, it's funny because, you know, Valentine would do his daily briefing in his office, and he had, you know, his office was right out of the Tommy Lasorda playbook. Lasorda, you know, Tommy and Bobby were so close going back to their days together with the Dodgers. And you'd walk into Valentine's office and they're pictures all over the wall of Bobby with, you know, various celebrities, dignitaries, you know, whoever it was, Joe DiMaggio, you know, Frank Sinatra, you know, it was, you know, and that was Tommy Lasorda. So, you know, Bobby would do his daily briefing in his office, and Phillips would hold a separate daily briefing on the field, almost to debunk half of the stuff that Valentine had said in the meeting in his office with reporters. So it was a very awkward dynamic, to say the least.
How different was it then when Art Howe comes in and is just an extremely different personality, I'm guessing?
Yeah, and I felt bad for Art because he was a good guy, and he was just you know, kind of overmatched by the whole New York experience. And you know, I talk about it in the book where, you know, they fire Valentine, and a big decision in Phillips choosing the next manager. He wanted somebody he could get along with because he just spent a few years, you know, at him and Valentine at each other's throats. And he finds Art Howe, who's this good guy, and he's got, you know, visions of this great relationship, and kind of overlooked, you know, a couple of things. A, whether Howe could handle New York, and B, I don't think Billy Beane was actively looking to get rid of Art Howe in Oakland. Maybe there's a reason for that. But yeah, and Art was just monotone, and you know, seemed detached. And he was the first, you know, Mickey Callaway, when he was here, used the term "we battled a lot." Well, that goes back to Art Howe. That was the Art Howe mm-hmm. default response to a tough loss. Well, we battled. Well, that doesn't wash with the Mets fans.
Yeah, you mentioned being in like Valentine's office on a daily basis. How different is it, and not just because of the pandemic and Zoom the last couple of years, but how different is it covering like the daily manager's press conference? Because now it's always on TV, and now it's always a press conference and not just like a conversation in the office.
Yeah, it's weird because you know, back then, and you know, even back before the pandemic, you know, with Terry Collins, it was more informal. You know, you could joke, you could ask stuff that maybe would you feel awkward doing on a Zoom call or you know, or on the with TV watching. It just the give and take isn't there. It's, you know, we've lost humanity, some humanity with these Zoom calls where, you know, you're not making the personal connections where everything's, you know, business-like and, you know, get to the point, you know, what's the information and, you know, something's obviously lost.
Yeah, like, you know, when I was covering Boston, I think John Farrell always knew, like, you know, when we're on the road or something and there was there was a big topic of conversation back in Boston. He always knew to like stick around in the dugout after he talked to the media. So, you know, kind of anything you got to you want to ask informally, we can BS back and forth about it. We can kind of diffuse the situation. I thought he was good at that dynamic, and we don't have that to any extent right now.
No, we really, you know, and this is the second year of Luis Rojas, and I feel like I know him to some degree, but on the other hand, I feel like I really don't know. I don't really know him because you don't have those interactions, those off the cuff moments, or, hey, you know, Louis, what'd you do last night? What restaurant you go? Just those little conversations to kind of find out what a person's about. You know, everything on the Zoom call is straightforward and all business, you know.
Yeah, going back to the book, like you get into the 2006 season, obviously, with the NLCS, that 06, 07, 08 stretch. I was a fan of the Mets at the time. It was made for very difficult Septembers and Octobers. What were those years like to cover? Like, which was the hardest for the Mets in your mind to go through?
Yeah, I think it's got to be 07, just the nature of it. And, you know, and at that point, there was a lot of sniping going on between the manager's office and the front office. You had, Tony Bernazard and Randolph didn't like each other. And, I think Randolph and his staff felt as if the front office wasn't doing enough to help him getting players at the trade deadline. The front office wasn't happy. There was factions of the front office not happy with Randolph, the way he was managing the team. So I look at 07 as kind of the epicenter of that whole thing. You know, 06, you know, obviously right there in game seven, and it's disappointing. But 07 to have that big lead and to fritter it away the way it happened. And then, you know, on top of everything else, to have – the last game of the season, Tom Glavine, future Hall of Famer, go out there and pitch, you know, one of the worst games of his career, and never make it out of the first inning. And he, you know, that sadly, you know, Glavine had a solid stretch with the Mets, but sadly, the way he'll always be remembered for that one game.
Yeah, and remembered for saying it was not devastating. And then afterward,
yeah, the comment, you know. He was asked about the devastation of the loss, and he said, well, you know, I'm not devastated. And I talked to him for the book about that. And he doesn't regret making that comment. He says, listen, devastation is for bigger things in life. But he says, looking back on it, I was embarrassed by that start. I was pissed about it. And he said, I was probably trying to cover it up a little bit, how pissed I was. And he says, when he looks back, if there's one game in his career he could do over, it'd be that game.
When he says something like that after the game, you know, the non-devastated comment, like, do you know right away, oh, that's not going to play well? Like, did you realize in the moment?
You know, you're standing there, and right off the bat, you know, you're thinking, oh, wow, this thing's going to snowball. And sure enough, it did. You know, that whole day was a crazy day, because leading into the game, there was some controversy, some remarks Billy Wagner had made to New York Magazine about Rick Peterson and Willie Randolph, that they weren't a lot of help with working with the pitchers. And, you know, that magazine article was coming out, and, here you have the Mets, you know, playing a game they need to win to get in the playoffs. And there's that controversy swelling going into the game. And then, you have Glavine go out and knock it out of the first inning. And you talk about a train wreck of a day. That was it.
Yeah, you had some interesting stuff from Wagner in the book. I got there in 2009, his last year, when he was coming back from Tommy John. I think he only made two appearances for them. But he seemed like a really interesting player to cover, like a guy who would be very open with you. And that's something that's very valuable in that market.
I enjoyed my time around Billy. You know, he's one of my favorite guys I ever covered, because he was so brutally honest. And, you know, he was that go-to guy in the clubhouse, whether things were going well or going badly. And, you know, he was kind of that barometer. You always knew where you stood with Billy, and he didn't pull any punches. And you know, you don't see too many guys like that anymore. It's more buttoned up now, and certainly, but yeah, you talk about favorite players I've covered. Billy Wagner's on that short list. Yeah.
Yeah. How much has that clubhouse dynamic changed in your time, you know, going from Shea Stadium to Citi Field, and just the ability to make a connection with players?
Yeah. It's obviously tougher now. And you know, in the last two seasons now that, you know, we're not getting in the clubhouse, obviously it's a totally different ballgame, but you know, it's been gravitating in that direction a little bit in recent years. And I don't know. I think players now are more from the time they come up are kind of taught to be more conservative around the media and not say anything. And whereas I think a previous generation just didn't care as much. And you know, maybe the PR people and the people running the team didn't care as much. Maybe they, you know, they liked those splashy back page headlines of a guy popping off about something. Whereas I think that's changed, you know, in the last 10 years or so.
I think in the back of the book, you mentioned that the Johan Santana no hitter in 2012 was one of your favorite stories to dive back into for the book. What was it like being there that night and then to kind of re-explore it 9 years later?
It was, and yeah, you talk about being there that night. Now, that was the night I remember I normally would have been off. It was a Friday night, and I think the Mets had just come off the road, and that's why I normally would have been off that night. But for some reason, there was a scheduling quirk, and I worked that night. And, yeah, you know, I thought Mike Baxter summed it up a little bit. The game is going along, and you get to the middle innings, and it doesn't feel like a no-hitter because he had, thrown a lot of pitches. There have been a few walks. And then you look up around the fifth and you're like, holy cow, Cardinals still don't have a hit. I probably didn't think he was going to do it just because of the way things had gone with the Mets with the no hitters. And, you know, there had been, I had covered one with a game John Maine took a no hitter into the, I think it was the eighth inning in 2008. Was it 08? 07, I think. I get 07 and 08, they get confused in my head because both seasons were, they ended against the Marlins and they were similar scenarios. Of Maine was 07, though. He took a no-hitter the second to last day of the season. And I thought John Maine actually that day was going to do it.
Yeah.
He was just mowing along that day.
Yeah, he had I think 14 strikeouts in that game, and like the Marlins had taken out a lot of their, like they'd taken out, like if Miguel Cabrera was still there, was out of the lineup, Hanley Ramirez I think came out of the lineup, so it seemed like he had it going.
That was one I was at that I thought, you know, the no hitter drought was going to end, but you know, Santana's I wasn't so sure. But the fun for me in writing that chapter was just kind of tackling it from a different perspective, talking to my post colleague Mike Vaccaro, who had was on this quest to see the final out of a no-hitter in person. And he would always, when it would get to the fifth inning, if he wasn't at the game, he would hop into his car and drive over to Shea Stadium or Yankee Stadium or Citi Field. And he did it. He did it again that night and was able to get there. And talking to him and Bobby Ojeda, who was in the SNY studio that night and who had taking a no-hitter into the ninth inning when he pitched for the Red Sox, and just kind of what he was watching and feeling as this one was unfolding. He had a sense something might be wrong with Santana because of the number of changeups he was throwing, and he felt the reason Santana was going to that pitch so much was because it was the one that hurt the least when he threw it. So, when I sat down to write the book, that was the first chapter I worked on, the first chapter I wrote, just because that was such a special. And one thing I liked was when I talked to Keith Hernandez about it, he said the final out of the no-hitter, he looked over and Gary Cohen was in tears next to him. It was an emotional night for Gary, who had grown up a Mets fan and, had seen so many close calls. And Gary, you know, tells me in the book that he never thought he'd see a Mets no-hitter. You know, he thought it was one of those things where it was just going to be a Mets thing. There's never a no-hitter. And he finally got to call the final out of it.
yeah, you figure you just get resigned to it at a certain point, that it was never going to happen. Looking at, you know, your chapter on the 2015 season, it is called Out of the Blue, and how much of it did that feel out of the blue that year? You know, they got off to the really good start in 15, but then kind of by June and July, we're kind of back in the middle of the pack.
Yeah, and I remember covering a series in Milwaukee in June, I believe it was, where, holy cow, they just couldn't score at all. It was just this brutal stretch of games, and the lineup was so bad. You know, and they had guys like John Mayberry Jr. in there and Eric Campbell. And, you know, you just didn't see the 15 team as being something that was going to have a chance. And then all of a sudden, in this stretch of a couple of weeks, Andy Alderson goes to work and really starts reinventing the team. They make trades for Kelly Johnson and Juan Uribe. They bring up Conforto. Trade for Tyler Clipper, and obviously the big fish at the deadline, Jan Cespedes. And you know, in the book, I go into the kind of the back and forth there was in the front office. You know, a lot of people didn't want Cespedes. They didn't think he was a fit. For one thing, you know, they wanted a center fielder, and that's obviously why they tried to get Carlos Gomez first from Milwaukee, and we all know what happened there with it falling through with Wilmer Flores crying on the field. And so they pivot to Cespedes, and, you know, it's like, oh, no, he's not a great fit, and do we really want to give up our top pitching prospect, Michael Fulmer, here? And it was a back and forth. Do you take a shot and go for it, or do you hold on to the pitching prospect? Ultimately, they took that shot to go for it, and they're happy they did.
When you look back at the book as a whole, like, what was your, I won't say favorite, like, what didn't you know that you learned going back to cover something? You know, like, you've got some good details, you know, whether it's Zach Wheeler saying that they wouldn't let him go to the playoff games for free, or Syndergaard talking about his lat.
Yeah, the one thing, the Syndergaard, when the lad, him saying that he had a good idea was going to happen, was kind of surprising to me. But the one thing, I go back to the Valentine firing, a story I stumbled upon was Valentine believes that he was fired because of a meeting that involved Jeff Wilpon. And I had never heard that story before. And the crux of it is, I won't give away too many details because I want people to be able to enjoy it if they read the book. But end of the 2002 season, which had been a, you know, disastrous year for the Mets. They had gone out and gotten, you know, that's when they brought in Mo Vaughn. They brought back Jeremy Burnitz, Robbie Alomar. All those guys were just finished at that point. And the team finished with whatever it was, 75 wins. But at the end of the season, Valentine said, Fred Wilpon told him that, your job's safe. We're going to bring you back for 2003. So Valentine says, okay. So he's getting ready to conduct his end of the year coaches meeting. And Fred Wilpon says, hey, Jeff Wilpon. Now, Jeff at that point hadn't really ascended in the organization. He was still kind of getting his feet wet because the Wilpons had just bought out Nelson Doubleday kind of at that point. But Fred says, hey, look, you know, I want Jeff immersed in all aspects of the organization. Can he sit in on your coaches meeting? And Valentine says, sure, I have no problem with that. And make a long story short, and I'm not going to give away the detail, but something happened in that coaches meeting involving Jeff Wilpon that Valentine is convinced got him fired, because a day or two later, Fred Wilpon came back to him. Fred Wilpon, who days earlier had told Valentine his job was safe, Fred Wilpon came back and said, Bobby, we're getting rid of you. And I had never heard that story before. Valentine is convinced that coach's meeting and with Jeff Wilpon in it is what got him fired.
That is an excellent tease, and I did enjoy that section of the book. You've been around this team for 23 years now, and you know, the Mets have this whole aesthetic to them that all of the craziest stuff happens to the Mets. What in your mind is the craziest day on the Mets beat? Like, we don't get normal days on the Mets beat. What one really stands out to you as the absolute craziest?
It's so hard to distinguish after a while, and you know, I was off I've been off, you know, so many of the days where stuff seems to happen, you know, but and this one included, but I still go back to the Adam Rubin day, you know, with Omar Minaya and they're announcing Tony Bernazar's fired and there's, you know, there's Omar Minaya going after Adam Rubin saying you lobbied for a job. And, you know, that one probably still takes the cake, but if I had to sit down and rank them, I might come up with something else, but that one right off the top of my head, you know, that's unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, I've told the story on the podcast before about I was an intern, so I was in the Rockies clubhouse, and that was just on TV, and Todd Helton walks over, and he's, what the fuck is happening there? So it's funny, like, you can sit down, you can write out 10 or 15 things probably in that time that would be the absolute craziest thing that happened for any other franchise.
You know, right, you had K-Rod beating up his father-in-law after a game at Citi Field. You know, just so much stuff, and a lot of it isn't popping into my head right now. But yeah, if I had to sit down and make a list, I would probably have a hard time differentiating, you know, some of this stuff.
Oh, Mike, thanks so much for taking the time to join us. The book is If These Walls Could Talk, Stories from the New York Mets Dugout, Locker Room, and Press Box. I read it in about a day and a half last weekend. So it's a great read. Really fun inside stories on the last 20, 25 years of the Mets. Thanks for joining us.
Well, I'm glad you liked it, Tim, and thanks for having me on.
Have a good one.
Thanks.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Thanks again to Mike Puma of the New York Post for that interview. Tim, we have a listener question before we wrap up. This one comes from Armand. Armand, I should say, is someone who, I did not cross paths with him. He was a student at the high school where I once worked, and his younger brother, Charlie, was one of my students. So it was nice to hear from him. He pointed out something interesting. He said, yesterday, I noticed a massive difference between Joey Lucchese's FIP, XFIP, and XERA, and his results on the field. Is he the unluckiest pitcher in baseball, or is there another explanation for why he underperforms his peripherals? I went to the stats and checked it out, and Armand is absolutely right. He Lucchese has been by and you know he hasn't pitched a lot of innings. So obviously the main thing is a small sample size caveat here, but if you look at the stat ERA minus FIP. Which was, so FIP is fielding independent pitching. It is an ERA estimator. The point of it is to try to predict, you know, how a guy would be performing in a context neutral environment. If he had average defensive play behind him, if his batted balls sort of followed predictable outcomes. And so by ERA minus FIP, you should be able to figure out the unluckiest pitchers in baseball. And by that stat, Lucchese is just a hair behind Tyler Webb of the Cardinals as the unluckiest pitcher in baseball for how with at least 10 innings pitched on the year. Do you think that it is just that, or is there something else at play here?
Yeah, I mean, I think he has been unlucky. The batting average on balls in play against Lucchese is 362. I think it's funny, like early in a season, fan bases latch on to new players who they don't know well, who are underperforming, and they want them catapulted in the direction of the sun. We saw
James McCann story.
Right. They feel that way about McCann, a little bit Lindor. We saw it with Kevin Pillar not that long ago, and now fans like him a lot more.
Yeah. Now he has established himself as the alpha male in the Mets clubhouse.
I mean, we saw it with J.D. Davis in 2019 when he was getting starts early in the year ahead of Jeff McNeil. I think Steve Traxel might be the ultimate example in Mets history. I remember the game where he gave up four home runs in one inning, maybe, and got sent down to the minor leagues. Fans did not like Steve Traxel. I, as a fan, did not like Steve Traxel. And Lucchesi is in the crosshairs of the fan base currently. Like, why is he on the roster? Why is he even under consideration to pitch any kind of innings for a team that needs innings? And so, you know, the results have not been good. The ERA is over nine, but the batting average on balls in play is really bad for a team who's defensively keeping it together in a way that the Mets aren't always doing that. And his strand rate, which is, you know, just the number of base runners you allow who do not score and is generally in baseball around 70 or 75%. Lucchesi's is 38.8%, which is actually, I think it's the lowest I've ever seen a strand rate.
Just to be clear, that's not an issue that he has, because I think the one thing you could point out about that, and it is something that some tends to show up in those big splits between ERA and FIP, is that some guys do struggle to pitch from the stretch, and so their results are worse with runners on base, and as such they have these sort of bigger splits than you would expect. Lucchesi, for his career, has a 72.5% strand rate. This year, it is basically half that.
Yeah, and I think you look at the individual innings that he's pitched, and they've either been like very good or very bad. This isn't like a string of he allows no runs on two hits, a walk, three left. There's not a lot of that in his innings. It's kind of a 1-2-3 inning. Or it's four runs on three hits, two walks, a home run, nobody left. That's kind of what his outings have been like, and it's kind of an extreme example of things we saw from Zach Wheeler for stretches of his Mets tenure, where I remember going back to 2018, the first couple months of that year, Wheeler, Jacob DeGrom was pitching all world by that point, and DeGrom I think had about 40% of his innings were 1-2-3 innings, and Wheeler had like 37 or 38% of his innings were 1-2-3 innings. And then ERA over five, because the innings when he allowed any base runners, they all scored. Like, he had a lot of 3 and 4 and 6 run innings against him. And it was just kind of a matter of quieting the big innings and pitching more comfortably out of the stretch. Even in 2019, when he again struggled a little bit the first half of the season, it was a stretch issue for him. So I wonder if that's... that's what it's been for Lucchesi. I actually haven't looked up kind of the splits of what the average against him is in the stretch versus not in the stretch. I'm going to say
It sounds like you're doing it right now.
While I look that up, with nobody.
If you want me
on,
to make stalling noises so you can start search, I could sing or something. But go on.
With nobody on base, opposing hitters are hitting 184 against Joey Lucchesi. With anybody on base, they're hitting 500. They're 12 for 24 with anyone on base, with 6 extra base hits. So
that's not good.
I think that is...
but how does that compare to his career? How does that compare to across his career?
Now you're going to make me make more...
if you're on Baseball Reference, you can do that in like 2 clicks.
Across his career... 230 average with nobody on and 285 with men on. So there is a pretty distinct difference there to begin with. So he's got to clean up stuff out of the stretch. Clearly, this is a more extreme example. Like, I'm not going to say that Joey Lucchesi deserves to have an ERA under 4 the way his FIP is under 4 currently. You deserve some of the results you get regardless of what your fielding independent numbers say. But I do think the 15 2/3 innings that he's thrown so far have not been the ERA is not representative of how he's pitched. He's been better than a 9 in that regard, and that I would not catapult him toward the sun. I would not designate him for assignment. I would not get rid of him off the team. I would look for a good opportunity to get him going, because clearly they're going to they could use 4 good innings from Joey Lucchesi in one of the games this weekend. And I think this is an opportunity to see what you got there and give him more of a shot to get there than they've given him so far.
Yeah, I would say that if you are, perhaps as Armand is, a Joey Lucchese defender, he is going to get some chances, right? Like they do not have the pitching depth to fire him into the sun.
Yeah, and everyone calling for Thomas Zupacki, who I am interested in seeing at the major league level. You know, I watched his game for Syracuse last week in the minors, and he pitched pretty well, although his line was not representative of how well he pitched. But there is always this, like, you want to see someone you haven't seen before. You want to see someone you haven't seen fail before.
Especially when it's a quasi-prospect, a guy from the system, a guy you've been hearing about for several years. Like, we know about Zupacki. Let's check this guy out.
I remember covering the Red Sox, and Jackie Bradley Jr. was that new thing, and he didn't. It took him a little while to find it in the major league. So in 2013 and 2014, fans did not like him. And then Mookie Betts came up in 2014, and I think Betts went like 0 for his first 10 in like his first three games. And I shouldn't. This is not the entire New England fan base. It was one person on Twitter or one person in our chat at the Providence Journal who was just like, okay, so Betts sucks. Who's next?
It was like,
yeah, that's not how it works. You don't get 10 at-bats and then you just move on to the next guy. And it worked out for a time for Mookie Betts in Boston. The fans generally liked him more than that guy did at that point in time.
That's good news for Khalil Lee, maybe, that your first 10 at-bats don't predict your major league career. Like, you could be Mookie Betts yet.
Yeah, they're not. You don't dismiss a guy based solely off of 10 at bats or off of 15 innings. You know, Lucchese was a pretty good league average starter in San Diego for two seasons. It's not like there's no history of him being successful in the major leagues as the pitcher that he is. So I think there's still reason for some optimism and encouragement with him yet.
If you have a question for the Metrospective podcast, you can ask Tim or myself on Twitter. Tim is at Tim Britton. I am at OG Ted Berg. Or you can email at asktedberg@gmail.com. And I will relay that question to Tim on this podcast. Please, if you're enjoying it, rate, review, subscribe, do all of those things, all of those places where you can listen to podcasts. Thanks again to Mike Puma. And thanks, as always, to you, Tim, for sharing this Mets knowledge.
Adios.
Peace.